This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl in your podcast feed. This week we were joined by a very special guest, Jackson Liebeck, who was the flight director for the Blue Ghost mission last year. We're going to learn a little bit more about that mission, but Jackson is someone who grew up in Pemberton, WA. He was one of three accepted into an international space education program in Texas when he was 17 years old. He later returned there for his degree in aerospace engineering at the University of Texas, and he is now based in the US working as a spacecraft systems engineer. This is huge. We got him while he was back in Australia to answer your questions about all things space, missions. What's it like leading these operations? Let's find out. Dr. Carl, how you doing?
I'm doing goodly, and I even do gooder when I go to space. I love space.
And we've got the person to take us there. Jackson Liebeck is our special guest today, who was the flight director for the Blue Ghost mission last year. Jackson, firstly, thank you and for being here and being on the show. Welcome to Science with Dr. Carl. And tell us about this mission. For anyone who's hearing this for the very first time, what was it all about? What did you do?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. So Blue Ghost Mission 1 was to go back to the moon. NASA is paying private companies to try and do it autonomously without astronauts. They could get to the moon, but it would take them a lot of money, so they're offering smaller contracts. So we tried to be the first company to successfully land on the moon commercially. And we did so around about this time last year on March 2nd. So we had 10 NASA payloads, we call them, so scientific instruments, that operated for a full lunar day on the lunar surface, which is about 14.7 Earth days.
Wow.
So we gathered over 100 gigabytes worth of data for NASA.
Now, Dr. Jackson, I remember reading that there was somebody who tried going to the moon, private, and they crash-landed. But from what you're saying, I'm assuming that you did what we call a controlled or soft landing?
Yeah, we did a soft landing, landed upright, the first to do it. It's not very easy to land on the moon. A couple companies under the same commercial lunar payload services program at NASA have tried and failed. So I think out of the four attempts, we're the only successful one.
And where were you located when you were the flight director? And can you explain to the audience what the flight director does and what they see in front of them?
Yeah, so sadly we don't have a live stream of us landing on the moon. We don't have the bandwidth when the spacecraft is so far away. Firefly is based in Austin, Texas, so we have a mission control room in Texas. And so in front of me was a bunch of different monitors with telemetry from the spacecraft, a bunch of ones and zeros that we turn into numbers that make sense. And that tells us how the spacecraft is behaving and what it's doing up there. And so as a flight director, you're the last decision. So a lot of my work was planning the procedures that we needed to run through to get from Earth to the moon and land on the moon. And then as work with all of the companies that had designed the payloads that we'd put on board to get their operations started and collect the data that they needed. So there was usually a team of about 20 to 30 of us in there when we were doing critical operations.
20 to 30?
Yeah.
Wow, because the only image I have of a control room is from that excellent movie called Apollo 13, where bad things happen and then the flight director takes over and says, failure is not an option. Was that you? Were you that person?
Luckily, I didn't have to say failure was not an option. We had probably plenty of people in the room that had been working on this for years that knew failure was not an option. But yeah, similar position to that.
Now, Jackson, you're from Pemberton, WA originally, and you were one of three people accepted into an international space education program in Texas when you were 17. How do you go from Pemberton, WA to Texas? Where did this kind of love of space and this field come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I always had a love of space. I like to say it was when I used to be able to look at the Milky Way. You're pretty privileged down here in the Southern Hemisphere, especially when you live in the country. And I took it for granted until I moved to the States. But yeah, I'd always wanted to get into space. It wasn't until my mum found out about this United Space School program, and they already sent a kid from Broken Hill and Trinity here in Perth to go every year. And so I applied to one of the open applications, they call it, and was able to get in and got to go to Houston, where they have NASA Johnson Space Center, where they do all of the Human Spaceflight Center training, and they have mission control there, and got to work with around 40 kids from around the world, just as interested as I was, and we planned a mission to Mars. So probably the most influential 2 weeks in my life and really kickstarted my career.
Wow.
But you were 17. How do you go to being older than that and running a team with 20 or 30 people in front of you trying to land something on the moon?
Yeah.
How do you go down that pathway?
It's interesting. I would say you have to embrace humility a little bit and just keep going. The thing that keeps you from being homesick is being busy, in my opinion. So I went and studied at the University of Texas at Austin. After I went on that camp, I decided I'm going to go to the States and do aerospace engineering. So a year later, I moved at the age of 18.
Wow.
And then I graduated in 2021. I worked for a startup, which was a very interesting environment, as their first engineer. And then I joined NASA for 2 years, where I got a lot of really, really good experience. And it kind of lined up perfectly because Firefly Aerospace was looking for engineers that had done mission operations on large satellites before, and that's what I was doing at NASA. And then, you know, it all lined up, and I was able to be one of the flight directors at Firefly Aerospace for the lunar mission.
But there's a few steps there along the way. Like, I'm not picking up a Texas accent. Are you deliberately keeping it in the background there while you're talking to us?
No, I try not to gain the American accent just yet. It helps when we speak to the ground stations down in Western Australia. So,
right. And then also you came from Pemberton, which I believe had some of the tallest trees the human race has ever seen. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have the third tallest trees in the world, the Kerry trees.
Yeah. I've climbed up. Is it in Pemberton? You got that big tree you can climb up?
Yeah, the Gloucester tree. Yeah,
that's really scary. Have you been up the top of that?
I have once, and I was scared.
I was scared too.
My mum used to climb it like every day at one point, so I don't know how she did it.
Oh my gosh!
Your mother would climb it every day.
Yep.
Was it for exercise or for fun?
For exercise. We used to live close for a little portion there when we lived down there, and she would walk to the Gloucester tree, climb it, climb down and go back.
Well, we're so lucky, Jackson. We've got you back in Australia on home ground to do science with Dr. Carl and for people to pick your brain. What kind of questions are you up for answering today?
Anything. If anyone, I know we usually talk a lot about science. I know you do, Dr. Carl. But if anyone's ever interested in the engineering side, how do you build a spacecraft? How do you actually operate a spacecraft? I've also tested rocket engines before, if anyone's interested in that process. And then I do a bit of a boring side, which is called systems engineering for aerospace now, which is a bit more on the logistical and technical side of spacecraft proposals and design before you get into the testing and operations.
Jackson, what's something that's kind of blown your mind in the last year that you've worked on?
Oh, boy. I would say testing rocket engines. How small the error can be when you're testing rocket engines and can blow up an engine is something incredible, and it's really hard to comprehend when you have 1,000 moving parts.
Because I've actually seen movies where they bolt this rocket engine to the ground and they just fire it, and there's just this hellfire coming out horizontally, and you get a hint of the awesome power.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly what I did when I worked at Firefly Aerospace. So we would install the rocket to what we call the test stand, and then we set up the test stand that's supposed to act like the rest of the rocket, and then you test the engine. You do a full duration cycle and make sure that it's good for launch.
And is that with liquid fuels rather than solid?
Yeah, liquid fuels, yep.
Amazing. We're going to get to some questions now, Jackson. We've got Michael in Nam, Melbourne. Dr. Michael, what do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. And Jackson, welcome back to Australia. My question's about the Van Allen belt. Does it actually pose any sort of major challenges to going for the missions to the moon? Not necessarily. And also, does it actually cause health issues to astronauts when they pass through it?
Mm. Jackson, do you want to give us a bit of background on that one?
Yeah, it's a good question. So both for humans and spacecraft, we have to do a lot of research about the Van Allen belt because you can have high radiation dosage there. It's not really how high the radiation is that we're more concerned about. It's time in the Van Allen belt. And so when you're going to the moon, you actually pass through it pretty quickly because you're orbiting Earth and then you do your translunar injection to get to the moon. And so it's not like you're sitting in the Van Allen belt. There is a chance that you could get a high radiation dose, which can have effect on humans. You know, they could get nauseous, fatigued, skin damage, but it's probably pretty rare because it's really a probability-based thing.
So how long are they in the Van Allen belt for on a typical trip from the Earth to the Moon? Like a minute, an hour, a day?
Yeah, it's less than a day, I think, when we did our analysis, because it takes about four days to get to the Moon once you do your translunar injection. And so the Van Allen belt's also not just this like light strip. It gets heavier and lighter in certain areas. So there can be parts that you're in the Van Allen belt that aren't actually too bad, and then you can pass through a zone that's has more radiation in it.
Now, I've got some numbers for you. There's many ways to measure radiation. And one of them is in a unit called a millisievert. Mm-hmm. And 3,000 millisieverts given over a period of an hour will kill half the humans who are exposed to it. And you're thinking, okay, that's 3,000 millisieverts over 1 hour. But when you're in the Van Allen belt, the outside of the spaceship gets 130, which is a lot less than 3,000, but the inside is made, it was made of metal. So on the inside, you only get 20 millisieverts. And if you're there for, say, a day, which is 24 hours, 20 by 2400, you get maybe one-tenth of the dose that could be fatal. And the thing about the astronauts, for I've spoken to a few who have been to the Moon and back, they're different from you and me, and they're prepared to take higher risks. And so they do it, and it doesn't kill them. They can get through and not die. They have got a higher risk of cancer, but they are prepared to accept that risk.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Yeah, correct. It is interesting. We designed the spacecraft, and NASA does, you know, they're not going to put any astronauts in real harm's way, are they? I'm sure that the astronauts sign a waiver that they're going through the Van Allen belt or something like that. But yeah, we designed the spacecraft so that it's very, very shielded. And like I said, it's really those prolonged durations. So if we ever want to go to Mars, the issue is you'll be in space for 8 months at higher radiation dosages. And so that can be a real problem. But on the way to the Moon, it's like you said, Dr. Carl, not too long, and we shield the astronauts.
Wow.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Michael. We've got Jamal here from Coffs Harbour. Dr. Jamal, what is your question about spacecraft?
Hi, I have a question for Jackson. So spacecraft design requires incredible innovation. You need to come up with never-before-thought-of solutions, difficult problems with tight constraints. So I'm really curious to understand what that creative process looks like.
Yeah, good question. The process is very interesting, and it really differs from spacecraft to spacecraft. At Firefly, we do things a little quicker. And by quick, I mean, I think start to finish when we got our Moonlander contract was about 5 years. And so what we really do is the first stage is looking at the proposal. And then we have, you know, tens, 20, 30s of engineers that are working on that proposal. And like you said, designing, they're innovating something that's never been done before. And so they have to do that. And then we go back to NASA and we show them our proposal, and they pick it apart. And then we get into the actual design reviews, which can take a year or two, where we're doing all the drawings, we're manufacturing, we're doing testing, and you'd be surprised. We could think that we have the best design, and then we get into the testing phase, and everything just flips on its head. Doesn't work like you expect it to. Things are heavier. Yeah.
Yeah. A colleague of mine, Tony Munger, worked at Darmstadt with the world's loudest loudspeaker known to the human race, owned by the European Space Agency. And it made the loudest sound possible, but also when a rocket takes off, it's incredibly noisy on the outside, and on the inside it's even louder. And he was telling me how they made a hinge, like a little metal hinge, maybe, you know, like the size of the palm of your hand, out of titanium. And it was, I think, 3 millimeters thick. And the sound alone tore three millimetres of titanium like it was tissue paper. So there's all sorts of, as you say, unexpected things you come across when you try to get this thing off the ground into the air.
Yeah, I think you're having to design hardware that is extremely sensitive for the harshest environments. And a lot of our designs are really just to survive the rocket launch into space. And then when you get to space, it gets very cold, hot. But yeah, we build the spacecraft in a clean room, And you have to be super, super careful. Even your hair follicles or your skin follicles could cause static electricity or pressure buildup somewhere on the spacecraft. And so it's really worrying when you've spent meticulous hours designing the spacecraft, putting it together, and then we have to put it on a vibration table to mimic launch, and you see it just shake all over the place. It gets you sweating a little bit. But yeah, wow. Like you said, Dr. Carl, the sound environment and the vibration environment of launch is really hazardous.
Damn. Jamal, thanks for your question.
Thank you.
And we've got Lisa from Murray Bridge, South Australia. Lisa, you got a question about light years. What do you want to know?
Yeah, hi guys. So I'm curious about, you know, how you look through a telescope and you're looking into space and everything's so far away, like light years away, that you're looking at it from like in the past. It could be hundreds or thousands or millions of years ago, that, and they might not be there anymore, those things. I'm wondering if the technology exists, if anyone's working on it, or if it will ever be possible to look into space and see that far away in sort of real time, or like sort of closer to real time.
Ah, so we're always living behind reality. So even when I'm standing next to you, you're picking up my image 0.3 of a second later because it has to be processed by the brain. And if the image is coming from the moon, there's roughly a second or so. And from Mars, say 10, 20 minutes, and the nearest star, 4 years. Is it possible? The answer is yes and no. No, because nothing can travel faster than light, and nobody has ever proved Einstein wrong. Yes, because I read a lot of science fiction and because of quantum mechanics. And there's this thing called spooky action at a distance, which Einstein just hated to pieces. But you had this concept of simultaneity, where if you, or quantum entanglement, look it up in Wikipedia, where if you have two particles that are created at the same time and they travel in opposite directions, they are always entangled. And if you do something to one of the particles a year later, then the other particle, a light year or two away, will experience the change at the same time. But there's a proviso that you can't send information, and the image of a star counts as information. So I'm saying no, 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 tiny yes, no, 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 who knows where quantum mechanics will take us, maybe yes. And also we've got the double slit experiment in time, probably no, but maybe yes.
Jackson, anything to add there?
No, I think I agree with Dr. Carl. We don't know what we don't know, but what we do know now means that it'll be very difficult. I do enjoy watching movies though, like Interstellar, where they play around with this a little bit and make you think.
We have Jackson Liebeck in the studio, who is originally from Pemberton, WA, and then made the move to Texas to be an aerospace, well, he studied aerospace engineering and he's now working as a spacecraft systems engineer.
And it took him only 10 years from going to the USA to go to space camp to being the guy in Apollo 13 running the control room and rescuing the astronauts from certain death.
Is that true, Jackson?
Yeah, we just didn't have astronauts. It was just expensive payloads from certain death.
But it took you 10 years though, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
That's amazing progress, man.
How do you feel working under pressure, Jackson? What's a moment where you've really had to lock in?
There's been plenty of moments under pressure. I think Blue Ghost Mission 1, we had a lot of anomalies. You're in space, things can happen. I kind of enjoyed it because that's when you really get to work and do something new. And when there's no humans on board, it's a little less stressful. You just get to enjoy it a bit more. Mm. When I started testing rocket engines, though, and there are a lot of technicians around, that was actually, in my opinion, more stressful because you didn't want to click the wrong button.
Mm. You went and studied at 17. Had you even had a part-time job before that? Had you worked at a fast food restaurant or?
My mum was always making sure that we were working, whether it was on the farm or at the pharmacy down the main street.
Okay.
So she always made us save up our money so we could buy our Ripsticks and our PlayStations and things.
I love that. From PlayStations to now, you know, aerospace engineering. Brent, you've got a question. What do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. My question is, what are the advantages for space travel if we had a moon base?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if we had a moon base, it would make launches incredibly easy, especially for interplanetary travel. So if you watch a rocket launch off of the Earth right now, it gets rid of its what's called its first stage, which is like 2/3 of the mass. And that all of that mass is for all of the engines of propellant just to get it out of the out of the Earth's atmosphere. And then we have a second stage to get us into the orbit that we want. So the moon has 1/6 of Earth's gravity, roughly. And so you could get to other planets much quicker and much more efficiently if you could launch from the moon. You're also further away from Earth where you're launching, so the Earth's gravitational pull is not as big. There's also a lot of other reasons that a moon base would be beneficial. We kind of see that there's some really rich resources on the moon. And we don't think of it as bringing them back to Earth. We think of it as not bringing these resources to the moon for those future moon bases. That's the real cost-saving aspect there. And we also don't want to be taking precious resources from Earth to the moon. And then there's other things. Like, we have tons and tons of satellites right now orbiting the Earth. And the moon gets to see one half of the Earth at all times. And so if you're able to bring some technology, you know, do some sort of GPS stuff from the moon, you could reach half of the globe instead of having thousands of satellites orbiting the Earth.
Hmm. Oh, fantastic.
Great. Thanks for your question, Brent. Thanks a lot. Harry in Geelong. Harry, you got a question about fuel.
Yeah, g'day there, doctors. I was just kind of wondering what the difference is in between the rocket fuel and then the fuel that we use in cars, and because obviously it's going into the orbit, does it have to have a lower freezing temperature and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's interesting about freezing temperatures. So for fuel on rockets, we actually like them to be at cryo temperatures anyway, so they're really, really low, you know, below 200 degrees Fahrenheit, so below 100 degrees Celsius. And we actually have oxygen as a liquid. And so when you have here on Earth the fuels for your cars, it's called sort of built on efficiency. You want them to last a long time, be good for your car. But for rockets, it's about max thrust in a really short amount of time. And so the fuels for rockets as well and spacecraft can actually be really toxic and hazardous. We use a propellant on our spacecraft. It's called hypergolic propellants, and they combust on contact, and so you don't need a catalyst. However, they're extremely hazardous, so you can't use them on Earth. And then for rockets, we actually use like a kerosene based with an oxidizer, and that oxidizer is just liquid oxygen coming through at cryogenic temperatures.
Now, can I add two questions there for Harry? Firstly, is it true that if you come in contact physically with hydrazine, a hypergolic liquid, that when you taste fish in your mouth, you know you're going to die? And secondly, can you explain specific impulse, which has the units of seconds, and they call it bounce per ounce? Can you explain that?
Sorry, I just want to be clear. Harry, not the caller. Jackson.
Jackson. But thank you, Harry, for
Harry
bringing us
from
here.
Geelong, we're not going to put you on the spot with that question, okay? Jackson, can you answer those?
Yeah, hypergolic propellants. If you do taste fish, if you taste anything funky and you've been exposed to hypergolic propellants, it is very quick. We have a lot of laws about how we handle hypergolic propellants, and it is really dangerous work. When we test our engines, because you need to test them somewhere, and so these are the small engine on our spacecraft, if the wind is going in the wrong direction, so towards a population base, there's a 1 in a million chance that you have a leak somewhere, they do not do the test.
And by the way, with regard to hypergolics and hydrazine, the Voyager spacecraft, which were launched maybe 40-something years ago, one of the thrusters died, and after a 40-year gap, they decided they had to use the other thruster, which had not been used in 4 decades. And the beauty of the hypergolic is that it worked. And Voyager didn't die.
Yeah.
Okay, bounce per ounce.
Bounce per ounce. Harry, thanks so much for your question.
Okay, so that's all right. Thank you.
And specific impulse. What is specific impulse?
Yeah, specific impulse, I always just think of it as thrust per unit flow of propellant. So with the amount of propellant that we have, how much thrust can we get out of it in the one specific time unit?
Oh, so that's why the unit of thrust or power is time, seconds.
It is time. So if you go through the equations, it's the derivative. And so what you end up with is flow, which is mass over time. So, yeah.
So you've got a high specific impulse for rocket fuel. Excellent.
Glenn in Port Stevens, what do you want to know?
I'd like to know why we go to space.
That is a great question. I think a lot of people don't know why we go to space. So first of all, humans not going to space, we need to. Everything, every piece of technology you use today uses space. If we didn't have satellites up there, we wouldn't be able to operate how we know it. You wouldn't have GPS. You wouldn't be able to text anyone. You wouldn't have quick internet. And then why do we send humans to space? It's to discover more. So space can tell us a lot of really interesting things. And I always like to, when I see kids, you know, if you grow plants here on Earth, you know, they're going to grow up. They want to get to water. They want to get to sunlight. But if you grow them in space, there is no up. So that can teach us a lot about the physiology of matter and why we're here on Earth. And we like to get to other planets so we can understand more.
And another use for going to space is being able to deal with killer asteroids. So back in 2015, on the 31st of October, we had the Halloween asteroid pass us. And yes, if you look at the photos, it does look kind of ghostly, and there are two eyes and a nose. And it passed roughly the distance between the Earth and the Moon. It wasn't 10 kilometres in diameter, like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs as part of that, but it was 0.6 of a kilometre, which would have created massive havoc. And if we had had 3 years warning that it was going to impact somewhere on planet Earth, we could have done something about it. As it was, we had 3 weeks. Mm. So part of going to space is developing the technology to protect us from killer rocks.
Yeah, and there's proposals out there right now with NASA that we even look into about how do you go visit an asteroid so you can learn more about it and prevent it in the future.
Amazing. Thanks, Glenn.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Eloise in Croydon, what do you want to know from Jackson?
Hi, we wanted to know, is there anyone or anything currently lost in space?
Hectic.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know of anyone lost in space, and hopefully when we were in the space race in the 60s, we didn't cover anything up. But there is definitely a lot of things lost in space. There's a lot of spacecraft that go up there and never make contact with the ground. So we have a ton that are orbiting the Earth that we don't know. And then also I like to the story, the old Apollo 12 rocket stage. So in 1969, we jettisoned off a rocket stage when we were on our way to the moon and we lost it. And it came back in 2002. And the reason for that is the sun happened to be in the exact right spot when we were going to the moon, that its influence pulled it in and it orbited the sun for, you know, 30 years. And then at one point, the Earth was in the exact right spot with the moon again, and it got pulled back into Earth's gravitational pull. And so we actually learned that it was on this weird cycle where it orbits the sun for 30 years, comes back and orbits the Earth.
And just a little short conspiracy theory one, what about the Black Knight satellite?
What's that?
I'm not actually familiar with the Black Knight satellite. You have to tell me, Dr. Carl.
Look it up on Wikipedia. Apparently it's a satellite that was put up by them or by the aliens, and it's only known to people inside the space industry who keep it a big secret from everybody else, even from you. So,
yeah,
oh my God,
be.
I've said too much. They'll probably send the assassins around tonight.
The Black Knight Knight with a K or
K.
An N? Oh, okay.
Don't tell anybody because otherwise you'll be a danger too.
All right.
Yeah, I might have to ask all my NASA friends, see what they think.
We'll keep it here, all between us. We've got Josh in Newcastle. Josh, I love this question. What do you want to ask?
I want to know, when he's watching sci-fi movies, does he prefer realistic ones or does he just like turn his brain off and watching lasers and stuff?
Jackson, what do you reckon?
That's a good question. If the movie is supposed to be realistic, then I like it to be realistic, and it really angers me when they purposely get things wrong or they know what they're doing. But if it's really sci-fi, like something like Star Wars or Star Trek, I just like watching those. They're usually for the storyline. I think there's a big one like The Martian, if you've ever watched that movie, and the author is an engineer and a scientist, so he gets everything pretty much right. But the movie directors, when they had the storm up on Mars, they made it really windy. But Mars's atmosphere is so thin that it would have been a light breeze. So us engineers didn't like watching that.
Okay.
Jackson, is there a movie that you reckon gets it very right?
Yeah, I actually really like First Man with Ryan Gosling. It was a biopic about Neil Armstrong. And that kind of goes into also the emotions of astronauts as well as their space travel. So it's not necessarily sci-fi too much, but they had to be very, very accurate.
Mm. Dr. Carl, what's yours?
For me, the best science fiction movies are books, because the pictures are always better. There is a whole genre of science fiction movies where it's the future, we've wrecked the world, everything's stuffed, the rich are okay, the poor are screwed and it rains a lot.
That's kind of it.
Yeah, there's a whole genre of them. I don't like them. Do you like, you know, the ones I talk about, Jackson?
Yeah, a little bit. I actually got to meet Gentry Lee recently, who was a JPL chief engineer, and he helped with a lot of science fiction writing, so I've got his books on my calendar to read.
Wow, amazing. Josh, thanks for your question.
That's all right. See you.
We got Tom in Newey, staying in Newcastle. What's your question?
Hey, doctors. I'm just wondering, do you think we will ever get faster than light travel? Like, does anything in the ongoing developments in quantum mechanics or AI make something like warp or the Alcubierre drive possible?
Okay, the Alcubierre drive. So look it up, Alcubierre. So if you are somewhere which is different from somewhere else, like you're in Alice Springs versus London, there's a lot of space between you and London. So under the Alcubierre effect, what you do is you shrink the space, you know, which has three dimensions, left, right, backwards, forwards, up, down. You shrink the space between Alice Springs and London and you expand the space behind you, and under the Alcubierre effect, you can theoretically, notice the word theoretically, travel to London in zero time. Not the speed of light, but zero time. There are a few problems, like we have to come up with negative mass. Negative mass? Oh, my God. The physicists, their eyes go... So it's theoretically possible, based on the fact that we also know that when the universe started off, there were 12 dimensions, and now we live in only four, and there are missing dimensions, which is one of the big problems, and understanding them in the future could make it possible. But right now, we got nothing. I mean, what's our maximum speed at the moment, Jackson? Is it 15 kilometers a second or something?
Yeah, something close to that. Yeah, I know that spacecraft orbit the Earth at around 10 kilometres a second, but you can get quicker than that.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, doctors.
Sorry, Tom.
Grace in Dairy Flat, what do you want to know?
Hi, I just wanted to know if you had any AI that was used in your spacecrafts and what was the coolest AI thing that you've come across in your job?
So we don't have AI directly used in our spacecraft just yet. AI really came onto the scene after we were well developing our spacecraft, but we do use AI now. I think the coolest usage that I've seen is the moon is really large and you try to pick spots to land. And so it would take humans hours and hours and hours to scour over those images and pick places, but we can actually use AI to try and correlate areas of interest and safe areas to land. So I think that's the most interesting thing. We can put in a lot of data and it can spit out, you know, the best places for us to look at.
Wow, great. Thanks, Grace.
Thank you.
Mark in Shepparton, what do you want to know?
Question on how you move something in space. Like on Earth, if you want to move an object, you apply force to another object. But in space, you're just pushing on nothing, aren't you?
That's a good question. So Newton's third law says for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. So in space, what we're trying to do is propel something another way. And by doing that, it propels us the opposite way. So if you look at rocket engines, you in space, you combust the gases, they light, and you direct them one specific direction. And because all of those particles that combust are going out in that one direction, the opposite reaction is the body of mass that's causing that going in the other direction. And so you have nothing, you don't need to push off of anything, you just need to create a reaction.
And Jackson, is a ramjet, which doesn't have a, you know, propeller thing at the front, is a ramjet an example of that where air comes in, is mixed with fuel and goes out?
Yep, exactly.
Amazing. Right,
awesome.
Thanks, Mark. So, Jackson, you were a part of a pretty incredible mission last year, right? The Blue Ghost mission. What are you working on now? What's something that you can give us a sneak peek into what your 2026 looks like?
Yeah, so Firefly specifically, we have three more moon landers. Our second one is going to the far side of the moon, people sometimes call it the dark side, but it's light just as much as the front side is.
Wow.
And so we're bringing different payloads there. That's another challenge because when you're on the other side of the moon, you cannot see or communicate with your moon lander. But we designed our moon lander to land autonomously the first time anyway. So we'll do the same thing on the far side of the moon. We actually have a payload from Australia that will be on that, Fleet Space Technologies. They have a seismic payload that will be deploying onto the moon's surface so they can take some measurements. We also have two more moon landers down the track, and then we also have our rocket launches that we keep trying to do. So we also launch rockets at Firefly. Me specifically, I still work on the spacecraft team, and I'm working for a group where we're designing new technology for the Defence Innovation Unit to prove that we can do things in low Earth orbit. So that's pretty exciting.
So exciting. Jackson, we've had a lot of people text in during the show as well saying, you know, how do I get into this industry? You know, what do I need to study? What would be your advice for anyone who's listening, feeling inspired, wanting to potentially get into aerospace engineering and get into the world of space?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when I went through 10 years ago, it felt a little bit more difficult and I didn't know what I didn't know. It wasn't until I moved to the States that I realized that anyone can work in space, and we have plenty of space actually companies here in Australia. You do not have to do aerospace engineering. The majority of people that I work with are not aerospace engineers. We actually have a fashion designer that she did engineering, but her main role was fashion design. And then she's the one that cuts up all our thermal blankets, designs them and wraps the spacecraft.
Wow.
And so anyone can really get into space. It's just about applying what you do in your education to space applications.
Oh, well, Jackson, we're so proud to have you over there from Pemberton, WA to Austin, Texas, working as a spacecraft systems engineer. Good luck for this year. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Science with Dr. Carl.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, the best. Dr. Carl, what an episode.
I'm insanely jealous that he gets to play the part of the mission control director and says, failure is not an option. He probably whispers it under his breath.
Jackson, do you?
Yeah, sometimes. He gets a little stressed.
Well, Jackson, thank you so much for answering our questions. If you want to listen back to this, you can catch the full episode wherever you get your podcast. Dr. Carl, we'll do this again next week. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl, and a big thank you to Jackson Liebeck for coming through. The text line absolutely lit up with questions. Even in the last 10 minutes, so many people with questions about the work that he does, about space. Fingers crossed we can get Jackson on the show again at some point in the future. If you want to know when that happens, you got to be subscribed. You got to be the first to know when that episode drops. Hit subscribe, like, do what you got to do to make sure we remain in your podcast feed here at Science with Dr. Carl. And if you want more space, you can check out last week's episode with Laura Dreesen, who is an astronomer, an expert in astrophysics, and looking particularly at the stars. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.